Right. This is session 26.
Module
26, equanimity. And it's not required reading, but we're drawing from The Places That Scare You by Pema Chodron. And before I get started, my style is a lot of discussion. So I'm actually not going to say a whole lot. I'm going to read a little bit, and I'm going to get a lot of input from everybody else. So the first thing I'd like to do before I crack this book open is ask, does anybody who's not a teacher know what the term equanimity is means, particularly as it pertains to Buddhism?
Non-attachment.
Non-attachment.
Spontaneous.
To
anything. Me.
Okay.
Not to myself.
Non-attachment. All right.
Did you say what it means in Buddhism, not the regular definition?
Yes, as it pertains to Buddhism.
No fear, expectations.
Okay. No fear and expectations. Anybody else?
Welcoming all.
Welcoming all. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you're sort of okay with everything.
Yeah, everything's okay.
Acceptance?
Mm-hmm. Acceptance?
Radical acceptance.
Yeah, that's right. Radical acceptance. Yep.
Looking at all viewpoints.
All viewpoints? Okay.
Equal taste.
Equal taste.
Mm-hmm.
Good. All right, I'm going to do a little reading here that Pema writes about equanimity. For those who are new to Buddhism, Maitri is also loving kindness. If there's anything else in here that I'm saying that you're wondering about, feel free to ask a question after the reading's done. By practicing Maitri, compassion, and rejoicing, we are training in thinking bigger, and opening up as wholeheartedly as we can to ourselves, to our friends, and even to the people we dislike. We are cultivating the unbiased state of equanimity. Without this fourth boundless quality, the other three are limited by our habit of liking and disliking, accepting and rejecting. Whenever someone asked a certain Zen master how he was, he would always answer, "I'm okay." Finally, one of his students said, "Roshi, how can you always be okay? You don't ever have a bad day?" The Zen master answered, "Sure I do. On bad days, I'm okay. On good days, I'm also okay." This is equanimity. The traditional image for equanimity is a banquet to which everyone is invited. That means that everyone and everything, without exception, is on the guest list. Consider your worst enemy. Consider someone who would do you harm. Consider Pol Pot, Hitler, and drug pushers hooking young people. Imagine inviting them to this feast. Training in equanimity is learning to open the door to all, welcoming all beings, inviting life to come visit. Of course, as certain guests arrive, we'll feel fear and aversion. We allow ourselves to open the doors just a crack, if that's all that we can presently do. We allow ourselves to shut the door when necessary. Cultivating equanimity is a work in progress. We aspire to spend our lives training in the loving kindness and courage that it takes to receive whatever appears. Sickness, health, poverty, wealth, sorrow, and joy. We welcome and get to know them all. What do you think about that?
Kind of where the rubber hits the road, because you can say, like, I'm good with whatever happens, and then the thing happens that you're like, I'm not good with this. And like, oh, I want to be good with this, and I'm not, you know, and to have to know, like, yeah, I can't actually do this right yet. I think her point of, like, we'd like to let everything in and sort of be okay and to acknowledge that there's stuff that's not going to be true of yet.
Yeah.
And some of it that we thought would be not hard, we're going to be like, oh, whoa, that's harder than I thought.
Mm-hmm.
is this related to when she talks about opening the door a crack as far as you can tolerate?
Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah.
Think of that.
Yeah.
To me, it's a challenge for every instance of changing circumstances. One has to be open, and she started with unbiased.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a brand new challenge practically all day long.
Simple, not easy.
Right.
I'm glad that she connected it to the loving kindness, because when I think of loving kindness, I, you know, when you do the loving kindness meditation, you start with may I happiness.
Yes.
Happiness. And I find that when I am lacking in equanimity, if I really look at it, it always comes down to I'm not okay. I'm looking at the things that I feel I'm lacking in, and that's what I see out there that I'm not open to accepting. You know what I'm saying? Is that you spot it, you got it syndrome?
Mm-hmm.
That so the heart of it is accepting, you know, I am okay. Not I'm okay with this and this and this, but I'm okay with me. And then, only then, can I open my heart to be okay with the stuff that's hard.
Mm-hmm. Christine, did you want to say something?
Yeah. About the limitlessness of it all was represented.
Can you talk a little louder?
The limitlessness of the concept is intimidating.
Mm.
That it's beyond accepting and rejecting. It's literally everything. It's the poor and the rich. Everyone's at the table.
So it sounds intimidating because it's so big.
Yes.
Can you start small?
Of course.
And I think that's what she said, like, you try to do that, but then you acknowledge that sometimes you can just do this.
Right.
And then you know, and you have to sort of titrate what you can do.
Mm-hmm. Crack the door a little bit further each time.
Mm-hmm. Well, and sometimes you might
you
know.
Just close.
I have two lessons today. Once before I came here and once after I arrived, where I had things planned and all set up, and then life happened and they were turned on their head, and I went into, oh my God, what do I do now? Panic of how to set things straight. And I'm sitting there trying to tell myself, life happens. You should have anticipated this. So it wasn't so hard afterward. But it's really hard to let go. I mean, I started to sit. It's really hard to stop that turning.
Mm-hmm.
Let go.
Mm.
But there's lots of opportunities to practice.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. And I hear what you're saying about, like, for me, I'll be in the middle of, like, this moment that's like my computer crashing and then not loading the backup. And I'm looking at all my data sitting on the cloud that I can't access. And I'm in panic mode. And in the back of my brain, or maybe in the forward, there's this voice going, this is okay, this isn't going to end your life, this is not really as big a deal as it feels like right now. But then there's the bigger part of the brain, right now it's on fire going, oh my God. I saw a great cartoon today of somebody sitting there roasting a marshmallow, and they said, roasting a marshmallow is a lot like life. You have to constantly be aware and be very patient. In the next panel, the marshmallow's on fire. It's like, oh, shit!
Yeah.
I
find I have the least amount of equanimity when I feel very separate from everybody else.
Mm.
And the thing that for me helps equanimity is to understand this is a part of what everybody, you know, even crashing computers, everybody in some way, in some form or the other, has experienced what I experienced.
And
just seeing that whole picture instead of just, oh boy, it's me, you know, I'm the only one who's going through this.
Right.
That helps to balance it.
You're right.
The thing that happened to me, though, I had it all in my head, and then when I went to take care of it, it was really easy, the first one. And I told my husband, I'm not going to have time to cook dinner. I have to deal with this now. It's going to take forever. I made a phone call. It was done in 10 minutes. He says, does that mean I get my dinner now? And, you know, I was someplace entirely else. I was ready for an hour on hold speaking to someone with an accent so thick I couldn't understand their English. I just knew that it was going to take all night. And I was convinced. No need for that. Totally honest.
So that's the thing about having an expectation?
Right. Right.
So does it mean living without expectation?
What do you think?
Kind of.
It's better if you know. Trust me.
I don't think that means living without goals, but you really don't know, like those phone calls. I mean, sometimes that's a good metaphor. Sometimes it's like only takes a few seconds or a minute and it gets resolved, and sometimes you're really on hold forever. Well, not forever, but
I think the only problem with expectations is the attachment to them. And when they fail, how we feel, we have to blame. That's the very first reaction for a lot of people, is blame is involved. And we say it to ourselves, I should have, I shouldn't have. And I like to say you're going to should all over yourself.
Should all over yourself.
So, you know, it's you can, I think you can say, well, if this and this happened, then this could happen. But when that doesn't happen, having a sense of humor might help with the equanimity.
I also wonder, this is just a spontaneous thought here, about devotion as a means with which to widen oneself to any particular situation. And I don't mean, I guess, what the traditional idea of devotion is, that some people may think in terms of a, you know, a particular religious, but I mean kind of an earnest willingness to drop whatever one is being attached to or thinking they're being attached to, and that just by the actual kind of intention, the open intention of that, that that can actually kind of create a little widening of perspective, of not being so set on one particular outcome over another.
Mm-hmm.
So it just creates just a little space.
Mm.
So by devotion, do you mean trust?
Mm-hmm.
Well, yes. I mean, I feel, for me, it feels very physical, actually.
Mm-hmm.
It feels kind of, it feels like a widening. That it's just, it's the same way that if I'm sitting on a cushion, that I have to start with my body and just watching different parts of my body kind of unfold or not, you know?
Yes.
And so it feels kind of like that, that opening, just physically, inwardly, though.
Mm.
It's sort of like opening to the, whatever path happens to be there.
Yeah.
As opposed to like, this is the path. You're just like, well, what's here? What's next?
Yeah.
And not, you know, take the next step. There it is.
Or I had
accepting the path that's in front of you as
yeah.
opposed to having an expectations of an expectation of how it's going to be for that particular time or moment, and then you try to step into it and it's not that,
yeah,
as opposed to just
what it
letting
is.
It be.
You see what it is and deal with that, and then you take the next step and something else is there, and you can't know. And it's when you know all of us put a lot of energy into, like, I want to know what's next, and I know I want to know what's going to happen, and you don't know, you know. And the wanting to know and thinking it's, if you don't know, you can't do something is sort of where your life gets very constricted, where the door is always shut. Because I don't want to go out unless I know exactly what's going to happen. And last time I went out, it wasn't that, so I'm not going out again.
And how many times have those of us who sit regularly said, I had a bad sit today, or I had a good sit, right? Like, meditation, which is working with whatever's there, could be good or bad.
Yeah.
The labels that we want to put on it, and the judgment that we want to carry with it.
And I also think there's a sense of vulnerability with equanimity. You know, like, it's great when you feel in charge and you're going to charge down this path and that's where you're going. But with equanimity, there's a sense, I think, of, because of the spaciousness, this more open quality, then there's more a sense of receptivity. And therefore, I feel more vulnerability because it's not so much, you know, me out there doing this, but more just opening to what comes.
Mm.
And accept, I mean, you use that word, acceptance, but receptivity and acceptance. And I want to just, you want to go ahead? I want to just piggyback off of that, and then something that Chris just said, in terms of, for me, I've noticed there's always this, at least one, if not multiple, intermediary steps in terms of, it's not like, oh, I see it, I accept. It's more that, for me, I know it's like, you should say it, I've let it. Not. Right, exactly.
She's in theater. That explains that.
So it's more about me witnessing, wow, I'm having a hard time accepting that. Can I be open to that? Can I be open to the discomfort that I feel with that? Can I send love and acceptance just to that part? Forget about, like, oh, I accept what, you know, it feels like it's this many-step journey that if I, you know, I want to land somewhere, well, maybe about being okay with not landing anywhere for a while.
Groundlessness.
Unpredictable. Yeah.
I was thinking, there's an ad on television. I'm a big PBS watcher, and this investment company makes me crazy. They always, oh, Kevin, and they go, ah, and then at the end he's this wealthy person. Oh, life well planned with Raymond James. Are you kidding me? You know, since when does anybody, you know, when is anyone ever able to stick with their plan for life? I mean, I was told life is plan B. Or, you know, you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans.
Uh-huh.
You know, I don't know. It's just insane. It's PBS, you think they'd do better.
While people were talking, I was thinking about the movie Harriet.
I want to see it.
Harriet Tubman. And Harriet Tubman. And far be it from me to read too much into the experience of someone from it. Everything is different from, you know, me in 2019.
Yeah.
But if I could just say what I thought. It felt to me like she let go of clinging to the notion that this injustice would stop her. That she had to, every step that she took, she had to let go of clinging to everything that was trying to keep her where she was. And it was when she opened up to that, that she would say, okay, no, we're going to go left. Left. Not right here, or whatever. You know, she... I just feel like there was something that was going on there that we can learn. Well, there's a lot, not just something. Mm-hmm. There's a lot going on there that we can all learn from. And it felt to me like she let go of a lot of clinging.
Didn't Nelson Mandela do that too when he was in prison?
Yes.
He made a choice in prison to not be a prisoner.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I remember reading a biography, not an autobiography, but a biography about him. And they interviewed a prison guard. And he said all the prison guards agreed that walking into his cell felt like being invited into his palace. Mm-hmm. You are not there in the attendance of a prisoner. It was that he just had a bearing about him and the way he interacted with the guards. He learned their language while being in prison. So he made a choice there that his situation would not define him. It's a pretty amazing story. If you haven't read anything about him, please do.
Wasn't there? I thought I heard here, maybe you mentioned anyway, about a famous Buddhist teacher who was tortured, Tibetan, and then his tortures became his disciples. Do you know what I'm talking about?
A couple of them, really important lamas who were, imprisoned for many years and tortured, viewed their guards and torturers as their teachers. That was the one thing. And then that seemed to, in some cases, affect the guards themselves, to where the guards became their students. Mm-hmm. That was true. It worked both ways. You know?
Mm-hmm. So I used to...
Thich Nhat Hanh was not treated very well.
What's that?
Thich Nhat Hanh. Uh-huh. In Vietnam. I mean, none of those Vietnamese monks were treated well. Mm-hmm.
I used to do prison ministry, the Catholic prison ministry, but it's the NCI Framingham, the women's prison, and there was a woman who used to go to everything, the Catholic service, the Protestant service, and she was Buddhist, and she, in the prison, and I don't know if this is true of all prisons, periodically, with no rhythm whatsoever, there would be something that come over the intercom they could barely understand. And it was loud and obnoxious, and it was a person's voice that was all staggy and hard to understand. So this woman said that she used that as her gong. That would be her call to wake up, so to speak. Another example of, it's okay.
Mm-hmm. When I was reading for this, the course, I came across this thing that all the immeasurables have a far enemy and a near enemy.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, right? And so for us, yes. And so like the far enemy of, the near enemy of self-compassion would be self-pity. You know, it's very difficult to sort of tweak it out, but it's there. You know, that's why it's a near enemy. You know, it masquerades as the real thing. And I read that the near enemy of equanimity is indifference. And when you talk about Mandela, they were not indifferent.
That's
they were,
right.
They were experiencing equanimity. But it would be very difficult not to cross that line, right? Yeah. And become indifferent.
What's the far? The
far enemy would be resistance.
Wait, no.
Of equanimity?
Equanimity.
Equanimity, the far enemy, which is easily recognized, is resistance. Is refusing, resisting, not accepting. And the near enemy is indifference.
Oh, yes. I see.
Yeah.
Right, so the far enemy is sort of the obvious thing.
Yes.
And the near. So that's interesting, because I see indifference as very much like turning off, you know, shutting off, whereas
resistance.
The acceptance is very active.
Right.
It's open, but it just feels active. It feels it's engaged, whereas indifference is really like very closed off.
And it's like saying, oh, anything goes, I don't care. Which can masquerade as, oh, I'm very calm and I accept it.
Right.
That's the near enemy.
Yeah.
And it all, you know, everywhere it says, be more careful about the near enemy.
Yeah.
Be more vigilant.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Let me read something about actually using this in our, working with this in our practice.
Mm-hmm.
To cultivate equanimity, we practice catching ourselves when we feel attraction or aversion before it hardens into grasping or negativity. We train in staying with the soft spot and using our biases as stepping stones for connecting with the confusion of others. Strong emotions are useful in this regard. Whatever arises, no matter how bad it feels, can be used to extend our kinship to others who have suffered the same kind of aggression or craving, who, just like us, get hooked by hope and fear. This is how we come to appreciate that everyone's in the same boat. We all desperately need more insight into what leads to happiness and what leads to pain. An on-the-spot equanimity practice is to walk down the street with the intention of staying as awake as possible to whomever we meet. This is training in being emotionally honest with ourselves and becoming more available to others. As we pass people, we simply notice whether we open or shut down. We notice if we feel attraction, aversion, or indifference without adding anything extra like self-judgment. We might feel compassion toward someone who looks depressed or cheered up by someone who's smiling to himself. We might feel fear of and aversion to another person without even knowing why. Noticing we are opening up and where we are shutting down without praise or blame is the basis of our practice. Practicing this way for even one block of a city street can be an eye-opener.
Mm-hmm. So actually, I often walk around downtown Waltham. And at some point I decided to just try to say hi to people, as I, you know, smile at people, say hi, whoever it is. And it was interesting to start notice when there were people I chose not to do that to.
Mm.
Like, what was that? Oh. Or that I hesitated. And so it's just that awareness of like,
yes,
oh, that person looks different in this way, so I didn't feel comfortable. And then to some, then eventually to get to the point where I'd step past that, say like, oh, well, there's some hesitation, but I don't have to go with that feeling.
Right.
You know, which is sort of knowing the feeling and then deciding if the feeling means anything.
Mm-hmm.
But it might be that you were sensitive enough to see that that person didn't want you to approach in that way. That's also possible.
That's
possible,
but it often was, you know, for instance, there was like one time it was a large young black man.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, I've been trained to not be friendly. I can be friendly. I mean, it's middle of Waltham. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not a place where it's dangerous to do this. You know, and literally a smile and a quiet hi, someone could just walk by and think I'm a nutcase and leave me alone. It's okay.
Unconscious bias is only unconscious if you're not conscious.
Exactly.
You're on the hook. You're already conscious.
And sometimes when you become conscious of it, you're like, now what do I do with this? And actually, if you just let it be there, change can happen.
Yeah.
Well, just, she says don't judge it.
That's right.
Yeah.
Just let it be there.
Well, what's the difference between honesty then and just letting it be there?
Honesty?
Yeah. To me, the notion of honesty is a person can have a bias, for example, a negative example. And a person would say, well, I'm just being honest and
just saying it like it is.
And so he could just let it. He said, well, I'm just being honest. That's the truth. And so they just let it be.
They just let it be.
The awareness of the honesty to me is the display of attachment or non-attachment or chaos or non-chaos or whatever. So a lot of people maintain their biases by saying just let it be. So to me it doesn't seem to be a good phrase.
So they're saying to just that their bias is okay just the way it is.
Yeah, because they're honest. Their idea is, well, if you're honest, then it must be okay.
I think I've heard stuff like that.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I've certainly, you know, hanging around with the homeless, which I used to do more. I mean, I was just being honest with them, you know, but they really sort of, you know, emotionally punched the person in the gut, you know. So.
Well, and I'm not sure honesty... About so basically, honesty being you're saying your opinion is the same as being unbiased.
It's not.
Yeah,
that's what I'm saying.
So, yeah. Right.
That's why the phrase is to me ambiguous when we were saying, you know, let our attachments, our affections, our perceptions display themselves, and just let them be. We don't have to.
Oh, I didn't hear you say that.
Yeah, I don't think it means you speak your bias. I think it means you recognize the bias in yourself and instead of acting on it.
Yeah.
You just let it kind of sit there without any action.
About the kindness.
What's that?
Otherwise, we're forgetting about the kindness.
Yes.
That's the very beginning.
Maitri. Right. Yeah. So if you choose to act on that bias, then that's the attachment to it. So I think the idea of just letting it be there is where the equanimity comes in. It's just don't act on it. Don't add to it. Don't do anything with it.
But I think there's also a piece that goes with it of sort of like sometimes seeing where that came from. Like if you so that idea like, oh, every time I see a black person, I wait a second before I decide to say hello. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, maybe because when I grew up, there were no black people in my town, so there's a discomfort there that's just built in because that's what I was trained with, but I actually know that that's, you know, I'm not in a dangerous place, mm-hmm. and I can let go of the idea that it is. Mm. I can know that I have it, it comes up, and I can let that idea go and set past it.
Yeah, investigation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But also, you know, it's like a cycle, the immeasurables. When you practice loving kindness, as you continue to practice loving kindness to black people, you might find that it doesn't come out then.
Right.
You know, I mean, these are all connected. It's not, you know, the four. So. Your difficult person might be a black person, you know, in that formula,
right.
Or whoever you think you have a problem with. But that's the point, you know, and doesn't
right.
happen.
Is it
overnight.
The person, or is it your conditioning towards that person?
The difficult person.
Yeah, I mean, is it really your? I'm to make sure I understand you. Are you saying that there was a specific person in your past that was a difficult person, and they happened to be black? Or my point is that it sounds like you're saying it's the conditioning and not the person.
I think she's talking about the practice, where the seven points where you start with yourself.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Right, and
choosing
the last
person.
One is to choose a difficult, you know, person that you. And then once you have the awareness, I mean, investigation is one part, which is, but it's all loving kindness can also have the same, you know, like it won't happen overnight, but
sure,
it's suddenly feel, yeah. And you know, the book that I gave, the Sharon's book, yeah, she says even the neutral person, you know, it's maybe the person, you know, at the dry cleaners, after a while, after you've done this, you suddenly feel, oh, I feel so very warmly about this neutral person. Yeah. So it's a good antidote to our difficult people and others.
I have this great quote from Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche. The everyday practice is simply to develop a complete acceptance and openness to all situations and emotions and to all people. Experience everything totally without mental reservation and blockages so that one never withdraws or centralizes oneself. I know that sounds like a really big concept.
Yes.
Yeah.
Did you hear that? What is centralizing?
What is centralizing into oneself? I think it's, to me, it sounds like I'm the center of everything.
You're creating a position of withdrawing for self-protection. It's completely congruent with everything we've been discussing tonight.
Okay.
Yeah.
Solidification.
You know, central headquarters is the problem of ego. It's all me that needs to be concerned about my world. Mm-hmm. You know.
Michael Levin always said, it's all about me. We all think.
Not
I
remember
no, it's about me.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Here's another good instruction from the in-between state on page 121. Dwelling in the in-between state requires learning to contain the paradox of something, of something's being both right and wrong, of someone's being strong and loving and also angry, uptight, and stingy. In that painful moment when we don't live up to our own standards, do we condemn ourselves or truly appreciate the paradox of being human? Can we forgive ourselves and stay in touch with our good and tender heart? When someone pushes our buttons, do we set out to make that person wrong? Or do we repress our reaction with, I'm supposed to be loving. How could I hold this negative thought? Our practice is to stay with the uneasiness and not solidify it into a view. We can meditate, do Tonglen, or simply look at the open sky. Anything that encourages us to stay on the brink and not solidify into a view.
So that's when things change. You're dealing with a difficult person, someone that one finds difficult. Maybe you're getting a sense of their being angry or depressed or something. Instead of the usual reaction of shutting off, which then sort of reinforces that, if there's actually a sort of acceptance of that, seeing what it is, mm-hmm. First of all, they may be a little surprised, and then you just kind of relax and even maybe smiling, and then there's room for change. Mm-hmm.
And I like what she says here, and I think she reiterates it in one of her many talks that I have, where she says, just do anything different than what you've been doing.
And she says it a lot of places.
Yeah. No matter what, just something to look up at the sky instead of reacting. Take a drink of water.
Take a breath.
Laugh. Something. Anything other than what your habit is to do. And that's where your change can begin.
That's good.
Yeah.
I had an interesting experience Sunday that I didn't get up as early as I planned, and my husband and I like to listen to the Sunday Puzzle and NPR, and I wanted to meditate for a certain amount of time, and I knew my meditation was running into that. Mm-hmm. My husband in the next room turned it on and answered the puzzle loudly each time, and I'm sitting there and thinking, I want to finish my meditation. I'm just going to notice how this feels.
Yeah.
What does it feel like to sit here? And I haven't actually thanked him yet for like letting me sit with, like, this is what it's like when I'm really irritated with somebody doing something. And instead of jumping up and going, are you kidding me? Like, do you know how loud you are? And, you know, and I just thought, oh, it's really interesting.
Sounds like he's pretty irritated, too.
What?
Sounds like he was pretty irritated that you weren't there with him.
No, I think he was pretty indifferent. He was going to listen.
He wasn't yelling.
He just was.
Oh, I thought that's what you said.
No, no, he was like just saying the answer. Like, I got the answer. I'm like, okay,
But he was talking to himself.
Oh, no, he was answering the questions on the radio.
He's talking to the radio.
He was giving the answers. It's like, oh, okay. This is like, and it was just such an interesting, like, oh, that's what it's like to sit and just get more and more irritated. Oh, okay. It was just very interesting. Instead of like the like jump up and yell, just you know, like, oh, it feels like this.
Mm-hmm. This is just so family, I think, you know.
Procedure.
So thinking on that idea of like existing in the in between and not solidifying, I'm pretty happy in that in between, and I've found that previously in my life and keep coming back to it. Where I trouble is working with other people who are deeply solidifying. Mm. Because I look at it and I'm like, just go to the in-between. Like, you don't have to be there, but I don't, like, that's where I just draw a giant question mark and never really know what to do, especially if they're people I really care about, people who make very harsh judgments or are not seeing the deep duality that is other people around them, and everything is just in a black and everything is just in a white. And I know that I can only control my thoughts and feelings, and I'm never going to change anyone else's, but it's really hard. They're like, these are the people you care and love about.
Isn't that right there the in-between?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because your in-between is just a slightly shade different, which is you're in-between and they're not. You got to be in-between with that.
it's hard. It's really hard.
It could be without even realizing it, a role model. Because people are so influenced by other people around them that certainly if you try to force them, that's not going to work.
No, never will. Role model.
Yeah. Well, sometimes the effects can be very subtle. It's not
right.
Like,
they usually are
contributing to a larger ball of wax, which could be. But I mean, that very position of being open and working with the situation and resting in that dynamic actually is your contribution. So, you know, that's what you can do. And it's okay.
Yeah. I'd like to connect this to the earlier quote with love and hate, because it seems to me that it's a major awareness or transition in maturity to all of a sudden become aware that I could love and hate the same person.
Yes.
At the same time. And to me, it connects with Buddhism because all of the incomprehensible, let's say, oneness, you know, the interconnectedness of the spaciousness and all that. And just what seems to be opposites, you know, exclusive of each other, is just a construct. Mm. And it's a terrible construct because it imprisons us in that duality.
And it imprisons everyone else, too.
Yeah. And so these two quotations are fantastic.
Yeah.
In my mind.